Industry chiefs, federal officials say, critical minerals diplomacy can end CCP dominance. The Trump administration negotiated critical minerals pacts with nations across three continents in 2025, a pace that will accelerate in 2026 as the United States and trading partners integrate mining and processing capacities to break free from China's manipulation of global metals markets. We have at least a dozen more we are discussing that I don't think have been made public yet with countries around the world, State Department Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary Reggie Singh said. The strategic impetus behind these is to build this ecosystem of private sector investment among all the countries we're signing MOUs with, Singh said during a day-long December 15 Center for Strategic and International Studies Forum in Washington. The United States and trading partners must work together because the Chinese Communist Party has spent decades tightening its grip on global supply chains, producing more than 70% of the world's refined critical minerals and 90% of the rare earths that manufacturers, including defense contractors, need. The first year of the second Trump administration has been a busy year for critical mineral diplomacy, with such pacts becoming a pillar of U.S. foreign policy, SAI's Hess Center for New Frontiers Director Eric Paloma said during his interview with Singh. It was one of the forum's seven exchanges with industry executives, administration officials, and congressional leaders, including Senators Catherine Cortez Masto and Bill Hagerty. CCP's domination of critical mineral supply chains is a generational problem, Paloma said. But we don't have a generation to fix what China has built over a long period of time. That will require deals for access to critical mineral deposits with nations across the world and investment in public-private partnerships to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative and diversify supply chains, Paloma said. Agreements with traditional partners like Australia and nations with processing expertise, such as Japan and South Korea, were signed in 2025, he said, as were pacts with new strategic partners, including Saudi Arabia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Malaysia, Thailand, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the first quarter of 2026, perhaps we'll get more of these signed, Singh said, and we'll have a critical mass of countries where we can coordinate policies with them to strengthen the critical mineral supply chain. It will be exciting in 2026. New tools, big bucks. SAI's Critical Minerals Security Program Director Dr. Grace Lynn Buscaran, in one of three panel discussions she moderated with industry leaders, said China has been using its foreign policy toolkit to secure minerals from around the world for more than 40 years, but under the Trump administration, we kind of took a page out of China's playbook, with mineral pacts and direct federal investment in mining and processing projects. Recent examples in the United States include the Department of Energy's 5% stake in Lithium Americas and 5% share in its Nevada project. 10% stake in Canada-based Trilogy Metals Alaska Mineral Development. And the Department of Defense's 15% stake and $400 million stock purchase in MP Materials Mountain Pass Rare Earths Mine in California. Such federal investments are now set to bolster overseas development, Buscaran said, calling the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation and Export-Import Bank of the United States the most significant contributors to advancing U.S. minerals diplomacy. DFC Critical Minerals and Energy Policy Director Tom Haslett said the agency, established in 2019 as the federal government's international investment arm, is poised to dramatically scale up global coordination through the Critical Minerals Consortium led by UK-based Oran Resource Partners, funneling $600 million into it. The consortium has also secured a $600 million stake from Abu Dhabi-based ADQ and the United Arab Emirates Sovereign Wealth Fund, Haslett said, bringing capital from an international trade partner that can help us resolve constraints in the critical mineral supply chain. DFC has been working to pivot our approach in the critical minerals and other sectors to align with the Trump administration's points of emphasis in economic and national security spheres, Haslett added. The corporation has been working behind the scenes to strengthen linkages with different parts of the U.S. government that are taking a leading role on the critical mineral supply chains front, he said. So that includes organizations like EXIM and the Department of Defense. DoD funding for critical mineral mining and processing is about to get a boost in the proposed $901 billion defense budget, Haslett said, with a maximum contingent liability of $205 billion, up from $60 billion, and a $5 billion revolving equity fund. So that gives us a lot of room to run, take more direct stakes and give more influence to the US government in sectors where there's a strategic rationale for doing so, he said. Brand equity. Cortez Masto told Buscarán that during a recent tour of Africa, she was disturbed by how many mining developments the CCP is financing on the continent, but from conversations with industry and political leaders, they're eager for other partners, as evidenced by the recent U.S. Democratic Republic of Congo deal. If you look at Africa, countries that went all in on investment with our strategic competitor over the past generation, they now have seen the downside of that. So they have an impetus to diversify, Singh said. African and South American countries that bought into China's Belt and Road Initiative have found it to be a one-way street, he said. When they interact with Chinese mining companies, there tends to be less local value add, Singh said. In many cases, Chinese workers are imported at all levels of organization, and you know, there's a lack of local benefit, often it's just the crude minerals being exported. That's not how Western miners operate, Singh said. You'll find there's an ethos of doing the right thing from the beginning. That works to our advantage. As opposed to what our strategic competitor has, have some brand equity. That really has a powerful pull in a lot of developing countries, he said. Emily Olson, Chief Sustainability and Corporate Affairs Officer for Brazilian-owned, Canada-based Vale Base Metals, agreed, noting that her company brings jobs and community engagement to every project it initiates. You start with jobs, right? We see this a lot in Asia, where invests in big projects, brings a Chinese workforce in to do Chinese projects, and then you do not have the benefit of developing and building that local economy, she said. In all my experience, ensuring that job creation piece is real will be very important in shifting development away from China, she added. Shared equity, a sense of local ownership with the promise of enduring benefit beyond the mine's lifespan, has been part of our success, Olson said, and has paid dividends for Vale in resolving issues and currying good relationships with local and national leaders. I fully believe in doing the right thing, she said. We need to really think about that as mining as we join with government and private equity to think about how we advance these projects at scale and at pace and what that role of the community needs to be.